Welcome to those of you who are considering facilitating the Compassion Resilience Toolkit for Parents and Caregivers. I'm Sue McKenzie, part of the Rogers InHealth team, and I'm joined by Emily Jonesberg, one of our team members.
Our main objective today is to walk you through the core concepts in the toolkit and to share with you what we've learned about implementing the content with groups of parents and caregivers. But before we dive into all that, I wanted to start by giving you a little background on how the toolkit came to be. InHealth started doing compassion resilience work with individuals in helping professions, primarily schools and healthcare. Teachers and nurses would come up to us afterwards and tell us how helpful it was for them in their profession, but especially for them as parents. This continuous feedback from the community and our own experience as parents led us to develop the Parent and Caregiver Compassion Resilience Toolkit. We began work with community partners to tweak our content for parents and caregivers. After completing a draft of the content, we piloted our curriculum with 3 different groups of caregivers, and each pilot was between 5 and 8 sessions long. Our pilots helped us learn something new about doing this work with parents and reinforce what we'd been hearing, that indeed parents and caregivers wanted to explore these topics together.
The content of the toolkit is broken into 8 segments or 8 sessions, and each session has a circle agenda that is for facilitators to help them to guide participants through the content. The main content we cover over these 8 sessions includes defining and practicing both compassion and self-compassion, compassion fatigue, exploring where we do and don't have control, expectations, boundaries, how we influence our family culture, and finally, self-care, although self-care tips are woven throughout the toolkit.
One of my biggest learnings when facilitating these types of conversations with parents was the need for sensitivity. Even as a parent myself, asking me to talk about what causes my compassion fatigue as a mom and how I behave as a result of my compassion fatigue feels much more personal to me than talking about my compassion fatigue as a social worker. In these pilots, I'd be prepared to ask the same question I'd ask of professionals and need to rework it for parents. I never wanted parents and caregivers in our groups to feel like I was oversimplifying their job as caregivers or that I truly knew what it was like to care for their specific children. This work also really challenged me as a facilitator. I've been facilitating group work for a little over 10 years, and these parent and caregiver circles were hard. For example, I remember in one of our groups, we had a married couple attend. As the group progressed, it became apparent that they were having some challenges as a couple that was impacting their parenting and their ability to stay out of a place of compassion fatigue. At times, our group started to feel like couples counseling with an audience of 7. It was challenging to figure out in the moment how to alter the dynamic to get the group back on track again. This work can be hard, which is why Sue and I wanted to share some of our perspective with toolkit facilitators to help you feel better prepared to address the challenges when they do arise.
Before we get to the actual 8 sessions, we wanted to take a look at a few big picture perspectives. First of all, mindfulness. Each session begins with a pretty quick and consistent mindful grounding experience. You may choose to do more if your group wants it. I like to think of practicing mindfulness as a way to train my often distracted mind to be more aware of myself and others in the moment. Like times when I was leaving the house with kids in tow and thinking of the list of errands I needed to do once we got to the car, but didn't notice one of my kids hadn't gone to the bathroom first, or that my anxiousness about getting it all done was being felt by my other child. Caregivers and parents reported in the pilots that the practice of mindfulness really helped them to be more in tune with what's happening in front and inside of them. As facilitators, be aware of how your group is responding to the grounding practices. You decide how quick or in-depth to go with those practices. That leads to a second big picture perspective, and that is one of building safety. Making those decisions around how much time you're going to spend in the grounding or mindfulness activity is also an example of how you build psychological safety for the group. If long grounding exercises leave some feeling uncomfortable or disengaged, make them brief. That will show that you are responding to the group's needs. Emily, I've noticed that you're really good at sensing how participants are feeling and then adjusting your approach to increase safety. I have seen you shift an opening question that was a bit personal to one that was more surface level in order to create a safer way for one of the participants to engage. We found that groups develop a sense of safety over time, and selecting questions that are less personal at first allows for growth towards such sharing. Creating safety includes setting clear expectations, such as, we will allow newcomers to the second session, but after that the group will be closed so we can build our sense of safety together. Or, I will email you after each session with the handouts we discuss. Such clear expectations help build a safe environment. The other thing to think about is the varying resources of parents. Another way that safety is created is when we keep in mind the diversity of parents' resources, such as time, finances, supportive friends or family. I find myself watching how I portray situations to avoid assumptions that everyone has the same resources or goals.
The sessions are designed to take place in a circle of chairs without a table or other furniture in the middle. This represents the sense of equanimity that we seek to support. People have been gathering in a circle to have conversations about important life events and situations for centuries. We are grateful to what has been passed down to us about how to support such conversations. One aspect of that is the use of a talking piece. The talking piece is given to the person who's speaking as a way to remind others to focus on listening. People are asked not to respond to what is said, but to let the person's comments simply be heard. However, as a facilitator, you can interrupt a participant to help them get back on track if their sharing has gone off topic or you need the group to move on. There's also a centerpiece in the circle that provides a place to rest your eyes as you contemplate your own reactions to what we are learning. Finally, the use of the circle also includes developing group agreements for how we will respect each other's values through our behavior in the circle. I'll touch more on circles later.
The information we learn and discuss is often personal in nature. As a facilitator, you will remind participants that we each have the right to our own feelings and perspectives. Invite the caregivers and parents to notice how they feel about what they hear and consider what the information from the program or the participant means to their caregiving. We each get to learn and take what fits and leave what does not fit for us. One reflection that is helpful for facilitators to do prior to the session is to ask ourselves how the content resonates with our personal experiences and practices. It's important to be aware so you can choose to focus on the participants during the session rather than getting your needs met. The parents and caregivers all come with their own story, and you will be assisting them to explore the intersection of their experience with the content. Try to do your work on yourself ahead of time. And lastly, before we get into the actual sessions, is the big picture notion of sitting with pain. As people bring their experience to the circle, there are often expressions of pain, loneliness, confusion, anger, and more. Our role is not to fix, but to sit with people in these moments. These moments are an important time for the facilitator to model the use of the steps of compassionate action introduced in session 2. That's the background. Now for the specific sessions.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the first time you bring people together. This first gathering of participants is so important. It sets the tone for the group and is often the deciding factor for participants as to whether or not they'll come back for the rest of the program. That being said, as caregivers, we often don't have spaces to talk about being a caregiver. So when we do find these spaces, it can be easy to dump all our stuff in the room. In all of our pilots, there was some heavy sharing by participants in our first session, and we received feedback that it was too heavy for some of those who attended. We adjusted the questions in session 1 to hopefully reduce some of this heavy sharing. As a facilitator, it is important to find a balance between participant sharing and content. I had a parent tell me recently she's done the dump at groups before, and while it felt better in the moment, it didn't last long. And then she didn't have any new skills to apply to lessen the stress in the future. That's why we ask facilitators to give participants a heads up that they shouldn't share their full story in the first group, but rather that there are opportunities to share bits and pieces of it throughout the 8 sessions. This allows the group to explore some of the content while learning about each other. In the first session, we also included self-compassion as the ending wellness practice in the circle agenda. Originally, we had this content closer to the end, but realized that self-compassion is foundational to acting towards others with compassion. We have also found that this is one of the harder concepts in the toolkit, being kind to ourselves. So putting it first gives us a chance to practice it more throughout the curriculum. As I mentioned earlier, all our agendas are done in a circle format to demonstrate the equanimity we seek to support. In the middle of your circle, you're going to want to have a centerpiece and core concepts you plan to discuss that session, or that were discussed in previous circles. After the first session, you'll have group agreements, group values, and family goals constructed. In our pilots, we typed up the group agreements and included the group values at the bottom of the page. We placed a few copies of these around the circle every session and placed a compiled list of family goals in the middle of the circle. They served as a good reminder as to why we were all here.
Session 2 is one of my favorite sessions. It's when we take a look at the steps of compassionate action. These are what we do when we see someone in pain and want to assist that person to lessen their pain. It is the foundation of this work, and for me, the easiest to understand yet hardest to do. So the first step is to notice another's pain. I talked earlier about how missing my anxiousness about getting all my errands done was causing pain for my daughter. Have a kid like that? A sponge for others' emotions? While my goal is to be present enough to know when my child or another adult is feeling pain, I can't be 100% present 100% of the time. As a facilitator, you'll be helping the participants to identify how their expectations of themselves can leave them feeling guilt about not being fully present for their children or others all the time. The goal here is to notice if you can be present and when you cannot, and to be able to state that in a compassionate manner. An example would be, I can see that you're having strong feelings about something, and I want to be able to talk to you about that. Can we talk in 30 minutes after I get dinner in the oven? What can you do while I'm getting ready to be with you? You're beginning to introduce concepts that will be looked at more deeply in later sessions, expectations and boundaries as supports for compassionate caregiving. Other steps of compassionate action include self-check, seeking to understand, empathy, and discerning best action. As you review these steps, consider how they apply to you as a facilitator. I had a few experiences when I found myself clearly trying to give advice rather than seek to understand the parent's perspective and the answers that she had for her family. Like I said, it isn't easy, but I'm clear that it's how best to be with people in pain. One resource we share with caregivers and parents in session 2 is a set of emotional regulation plans for children. These plans engage the child in discussing what situations lead them to having big feelings and the behaviors that sometimes arise that lead to problems. They then consider what other options they have that are calming and soothing, and also what they want adults in their lives to do to support them. Some of the parents in the pilots reported working on these with their children and learning some good information about their child. It was helpful to have an agreed-upon plan for how they will try to regulate themselves in the future. These plans look complicated at first, but they really come down to a kid developing their own story about their feelings, their actions, and what they are working on to be able to enjoy more of their day rather than experiencing the consequences of dysregulation. All of this has to be done in the context of the child's unique abilities and supports. And of course, all of us should have our own emotion story that we can share with our family. We suggest that the adults create a plan to share with their child and work together on coping and calming strategies.
In session 3, we discuss compassion fatigue and present it through a visual that shows the different stages. In all of our pilots, participants spoke to the power of looking at the cycle of compassion fatigue and how normalizing it was for them. They were or had experienced the different stages in the cycle and just didn't have words for it. We had one parent share that this cycle was the most important part of the curriculum for her. She realized she was doing things in the zombie stage without realizing it, and it helped her set boundaries and ask for help in a way she hadn't before. Participants were really able to personalize the cycle with examples from their own caregiving story. We also talk about the role shame and blame has in someone's progression throughout the cycle. For example, as a parent, I place a lot of shame on myself for not being more engaged with my child when I'm in the withdrawal stage. And often that shame just pushes me further through the cycle, moving me to zombie phase. Shame and blame are often such a piece of people's compassion fatigue story, and having a chance to unpack that can help them challenge these feelings of shame and blame in the future. One tricky thing that came up for me when I was facilitating this piece was having parents talk about their experience being stuck in a place of the cycle and not being sure how to get out of it, or in the case of one of the caregivers in one of my groups, being stuck in a place of the cycle and not being aware of it. It took a lot for me to resist getting into fix-it mode. I reflected back on the steps of compassion and action and did my best to listen and reflect back, opening it up to the group when appropriate. And sometimes participants will leave group with something more to think about and not necessarily answers or solutions.
In session four, we look at what is leading to compassion fatigue very specifically and identify where we have control and where we do not have control. We do this so we can focus our energies in action areas versus negativity and helplessness. Participants get to hear how others perceive control and consider situations where they might currently feel helpless, but see that some others have found a way to increase personal power in that same situation. An important perspective during this exercise is when we also look at what leads to our resilience. Caregivers and parents often realize that they have a good ability to access small resilience builders that add up to the strength that gets them through their days with compassion.
Another thing that often surfaces during the driver's exercise is the impact of our own expectations on our well-being. Oftentimes, we set expectations for ourselves and our family members that are either unrealistic or aren't clearly communicated. Both of these have such a big impact on our joy and our relationships with our family members. In session five, we explore these expectations and the impact our own parents' expectations had on us as children and still do as adults. Participants in all our pilots talked about how they were doing things with their kids because of the way their parents did or didn't do these things with them. One example is a caregiver in one of our groups shared that an expectation of hers growing up was that she was always independent. She talked about how she'd like her children to feel more comfortable asking for support from others, and also realized in times of stress that wasn't her default. She'd get frustrated when her children would ask for help when she felt they didn't need it, and thought she may have unrealistic expectations of what her children should be able to accomplish independently. She also talked about how this is still an expectation she has for herself, and how this negatively impacts her ability to ask for help when it comes to parenting.
In session six, the main activity involves listing specific behaviors that we believe would lead to a healthy family culture if all did them. The caregivers and parents then consider what they might need to say no to in order to be able to consistently act in those ways. We are looking at what no's are needed in our life to support our big yeses or our best selves. In other words, what boundaries support us being our best selves. Boundaries are a challenge for most caring people. Somehow saying yes just feels so much better in the moment than saying no. As you facilitate this session, remember that for some, the idea of setting a boundary from a calm and compassionate place is quite new and may raise some skepticism. Don't try to simplify this complex aspect of parenting, but do bring concrete and relevant examples to share. Allow the group to wrestle with the challenge.
In session seven, we explore the model of influence. This model has caregivers identify a desired behavior they wish to see in their children and walks them through a way to consider influencing this behavior, which ultimately influences the family's culture. Let's say, for example, I want my child to be kind to others. In the first column of the model, I'm looking at what I can do to increase my child's knowledge of what being kind includes. First, I need to make sure I'm communicating what this really means to my child. For me, this would include supporting others when they're in need of help, greeting people when you see them as a way of acknowledging them, and saying please and thank you when interacting with them. In addition to what my words are sharing, I also need to model this for my child. Am I doing these things when we're at the grocery store, when I'm on the phone with a friend, or interacting with a stranger on the street? The way I model this behavior is going to be much more impactful than the words I use to explain it. I also need to find ways for my child to practice this behavior, starting with ones that are low risk first. Can I give my daughter a chance to practice being kind with a friend before I ask her to be kind to a stranger? In addition to building my child's knowledge, I also need to develop their will to fulfill the desired behavior. The first part of this is my attitude. Do I believe my child can be kind? How do I show that I believe this is the case? What supports do I think they need in place to be kind to others? In addition to my attitude, I also have to have consistent consequences. And more than punishing her when she isn't kind, am I finding opportunities to reward and acknowledge her when she is? And when a consequence is necessary, am I leaning on natural consequences as much as possible? If she hasn't been kind to a classmate and therefore doesn't get invited to a party, do I give her space to sit in that sadness to reflect on the impact her behavior had on another? The last part of the model is that of grace, and it's so important. When my child doesn't meet the expected behavior, how do I give her some grace so she knows I believe in her, that all humans make mistakes, and that I'm there to support her in figuring out how to pick up the pieces and prevent this from happening in the future? One thing that's really important to point out is that this is a model. and that's it. No model is going to work for every person, and nothing is going to be as simple as the model suggests. However, talking about this model does give participants a chance to reflect on their role in influencing the culture of their family, and how our responses as caregivers to each section of this model can have an impact on our well-being and our ability to be compassionate to others.
In the last session, we take a focused look at self-care. Throughout the prior sessions, we have woven self-care practices such as gratitude, mindful pauses, affirmations, etc., to the content of that session. This session pulls those practices together and adds perspective taking about stress, the importance of seeing our values play out in our caregiving, and recognizing our own competence and value each day. We want to remember that each of us has a different level of resources, including time, money, people supports, physical health, etc., that we can put towards ourselves. If I am caring for an ill parent or spouse and three children, I don't need to hear that I should be spending time on myself. Instead, I could be invited to consider any untapped support or brief practices that will assist me through a challenging time in my life. One resource for facilitators that I want to be sure and point out is a list of mindfulness practices for you to pull from for your sessions or share with participants. That is found on the website appendix area.
Soon, I hope you're able to use the resources in this toolkit to bring caregivers together around building each other's compassion resilience. Remember to set realistic expectations and set boundaries when appropriate in this process so you can take care of yourself too. We definitely don't want this work to add to a facilitator's compassion fatigue. Also know that the staff at Rogers InHealth is here and willing to support you in your work. So please feel free to reach out with any questions. And drop us a note every once in a while and let us know how you're using the toolkit. This helps us build our resilience as well. You can reach us via email at wise@wisewisconsin.org. We wish you a fulfilling journey in building the compassion resilience of yourself and those around you.